start that again.
Yeah.
Yes, so, yes.
School was built there in the 1930s, pre-war, and it got very heavily bombed during the war. The whole front was blown out, and it was pulled back in again. After the war, they created a map of London which shows London coloured in from dark red to yellow, and yellow shows kind of minimal damage, and dark red shows this should probably be flattened.
Yeah.
So the school is dark red. This map again used to be in County Hall, probably still is.
Yes.
Somewhere.
Yeah.
They pulled the whole of the front of wall back in.
Really.
So that whole front that you see when you drive around the Oval, that must have been. I've seen photographs of it out at about 30 degrees.
Goodness.
Blown out.
They were able to do that and still the building was okay.
I think, you know, it probably the argument was, yeah, the school's there. It's the school. And once the fact that they could find the school, and then we used to do site visit. You know, the big thing about SHP is the looking at a site and how it evolved. Mm. So we did this is probably my teaching notes on that, or I don't know.
Looks like you had reasonably good access to reproduction.
Yeah, we had one of the, the great thing about teaching in Ilia was the resources. So, you know, I had slide projector, film projector. We had a media resources officer.
For Ilia?
Within the school.
Within your school?
So
was that a member of staff, or was it?
Well, he was a member, full-time member of staff. He worked with the librarian. So there was, if you, we call them support staff now, wouldn't we?
Yeah. So it was called
media resource, an MRO. Mm-hmm. This desire to produce. There are other things here that you recognise. This is making the Mark Pullen exercise accessible to. It's quite interesting.
To a lower age group?
Because I used to use this with first years, whereas Mark Pullen was designed for 13-year-olds.
Yeah.
But just shows how you can go wrong. I suppose I was using this before we went comprehensive, but I can remember with the comprehensive intake, some of them had real problems being able to read a wristwatch. Yeah. You know, one of the things with Mark Pullen is the wristwatch has stopped. Mm. So I thought, oh, right, clever, I'll make it a digital watch. No problem. So I put a digital watch up, and of course one kid said, hang on, if it stopped in its digital watch, it'd be blank.
Oh, it's absolutely right. Yeah.
So, you know, so that was what this was designed to do, and it was a lot simpler. It was designed to be much more accessible. But this was the first thing that pupils coming into Archbishop Tenison's in 1978 did. If they were doing history.
And then you followed that, as it seems, with your own booklets.
Yeah. Well, so. A lot of the time, we did have textbooks, and a lot of them are in there. But, we did a lot.
Cutting and pasting. And
yeah.
Transposing diagrams.
I think there was a generation, particularly that came up probably through the 70s, which actually were much more into creating their own resources because they could. I mean, and this was before computers. I mean,
yeah, it's just a photocopying machine.
It was a photocopying of banders. Don't seem to have survived. I think these must have replaced bander. Mm. And looking at them now, I think this is a bit. You know, I was looking at those maps then and thinking they're not particularly accessible. But and this, I used to condemn as an advisory teacher the activity which would be called colouring across the curriculum. But I'm fairly sure that one exercise probably was. Colour these in. I hate to think. We had a lot of TV programmes. We had masses of film strips which we turned largely into slides. I can remember spending ages cutting film strips up and putting them into slide frames.
Yeah.
And then we had drawers and drawers and drawers of slides.
When you say you've got lots of TV programmes, so now we're into video.
Yeah.
Late 70s,
well,
early 80s.
Yeah, it would have been video. But Ilya also used to have a very good film loan system. Mm. And when I started, we had a strong tradition that, you know, films arrived in certain weeks, so whatever you were doing, you had to watch that film that week, you know, and or you had to keep up. That was another reason why you had to follow the textbook, because you had to keep up.
Would this be used with mixed ability groups?
Yeah. When we went comprehensive, we started off with streamed classes, ATGS, and then it became ATS when we moved to three. Interestingly, the lower ability classes were almost exclusively black, because Archbishop Tennyson's went from being something like 80% white to 75% black, because it drew, as a grammar school, it had drawn its intake more broadly. Once it became a comprehensive, it drew it largely from Brixton Road, Kennington, mm. and such like. And that in itself created its own problems. And I was fairly sure that streaming was a good idea until I actually taught the S sets. And I thought, as head of department, I should, as you did.
Yeah.
And I thought I could teach until then. I used to go in with 3 or 4 lesson plans, because I never knew. There was only 10 kids in this S set. And I just found it very hard work. And in the end, we as a school, went over to mixed ability. So these would have been done for mixed ability teaching. So the aim was accessibility all the way through. And a lot of these are very straightforward comprehension type questions, really.
So they'd be using a textbook to help them answer that, presumably.
Yeah, and this booklet.
Yeah.
And I'll show you the kind of book we had. In fact, I can show you the textbook. And this finding out about Vikings was largely drawing on Sutton Hoo stuff. But also some of this was from... Remember, in the 70s and 80s, the other great resource was not textbooks so much, but whole evidence packs that were being produced by not only Jackdaw, but by there was a resource centre somewhere in Yorkshire who produced masses and masses of stuff, and also produced it at different, aimed at different levels of ability, so you could have this whole pack and you could say, well, you know, this is most appropriate, this booklet's most appropriate. And, that. And you know, for people like yourself who've moved from a grammar school into mixed ability teaching, then these resources seem to provide us with some kind of differentiation. I think it's that point when I started realising that actually they were differentiating on language, not on history.
I ought to look for those evidence packs.
I can't ask Kate about them. Because
yes,
she,
I will.
I can't remember now what they were. I've got a feeling that some of these were probably nicked from them.
Yeah. It looks like from the point of view of content, you're going through a fairly traditional run through from Celts,
Vikings, are up there.
1060 Normans, Anglo-Saxons must be in there somewhere.
Yeah, oh yeah, very much so. This is, you can see, you know, this is pre-national curriculum because it's year one. So, autumn, nature of sources, simple deduction. Yeah. So, accident unit, Celtic unit, life in Celtic times. Interesting, though, that the objectives are down this side, the content's down that side. So this must be from the 80s. There's no data, of course. You know, you don't expect a historian to put it.
But you've got a local study, haven't you, with London.
Then Unit 2, visit to London Museum and St Albans. And then castles, change and development. So you've got a fairly traditional. But and then Unit 4, life in castles, knights and armour. And then Unit 5, Viking world, taught in conjunction with the English department. So, yeah, first year, Romans to Vikings, with castles thrown in as a development study. Second year, voyages of exploration, Amerindians, Aztecs, Caribs, Arawaks. That was probably very much as a result of the kind of multicultural emphasis that you were getting in Ilya in the 80s. Then you've got Richard III, Death of the Princes, Tudor Monarchs, so Who Killed the Princes, exercise. Visit Hampton Court, Lambeth Palace. I mean, Lambeth Palace was just up the road. Mm. So it's a great place to teach them. And then Life in Tudor and Stuart London. So, and then third year, so Tudors, not much Stuarts as it turns out. In fact, there's not much content in there at all. And then Agriculture and Industrial Revolution.
You didn't do the Black Death, did you?
No. and then America, War of Independence.
Right.
And then a bit on South Africa and apartheid, although I can never remember teaching that.
So it looks like this.
Probably
was,
because as a history teacher you'll know you never got to the end of your syllabus.
No. But you put that in to sort of give a more global context to it.
I think so. I put it in as a modern world study as well.
Yeah.
So,
I wonder why you went for the American Revolution.
Because again, if you go back to what I started teaching, when I started teaching, this is not far from what the syllabus had been under Bill, in the sense that it was, you know, Celts to Middle Ages, Tudors and Stuarts, Industrial Revolution, American War of Independence, French Revolution.
And then
that set you up for starting 1815 and onwards. And I guess what this reflects, if we see this as the kind of late 80s, is the way that I kind of narrowed the syllabus. Mm. In part to do things in greater depth. And I think that is the tension that you were experiencing throughout the whole of the 70s and 80s. If you were going to do more on sources, you were going to do more on cause, you ended up doing less.
Yeah.
But you did it better. So it's a question of whether you gave them this kind of very thin veneer of knowledge. And then you get into... This was the SHP. And as I say, this is very much... Yeah, there you are.
So you didn't actually do much 20th century history, did you?
No.
Did you think that was a gap, or you just...
Well, I think that probably explains why that South Africa unit was put in towards the end. I would reckon this is probably about 1985, 1986, just before I went to be an advisory teacher.
And did the children get a choice of whether to do history or not?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So quite a lot of them would have done something else and not continue.
Although, I mean, when I first started teaching at the grammar school, they used to choose whether they did history or not at the end of year 8.
Oh, right.
So in year 9 you had smaller groups and you already had self-selecting groups. Then we shifted, as most schools did, to year 9. And this whole issue of whether in fact history should be compulsory or optional post year 9 is quite an interesting one. I was always in favour of, you know, the great value, it seemed to me, of people choosing history post year 9 was that people wanted to be doing the subject you were doing, as opposed to people who were forced and dragooned into doing it. So you could always work on that, and you could always do it. And so we always used to have more than 50%. And the interesting thing about the shift to SHP was that we managed to keep the results very similar to what they'd been in the grammar school. It was the only subject that did. And that wasn't the fact that I was chief examiner for the syllabus either. I mean, it was the fact that the course, with the coursework element, we got a lot more out of the kids. They really took to the idea that by the time they went into the exam, they already knew 40% of their mark.
But that time, that would be virtually the only subject with a coursework element.
No, I think there were other subjects that did have coursework. And indeed, in terms of joint O-level CSE, a lot of those had at least 20% coursework.
Mm.
But you're right, I mean, we went from an O level which had no coursework whatsoever to a subject that had 40% coursework. But I can remember those kind of early days, the big tension within the school was the amount of coursework that students had and the problems that everybody wanted their coursework at the same time. This sort of thing. This is... Just just...
How many members of staff did you have teaching history at Tennyson's?
Two.
Oh, right, so small department.
Yeah, me and somebody else.
Yeah.
And we had the odd person who did lessons in between. The person, when I finished, when I went to be an advisory teacher, the person working with me was a woman called Heather Dolphin, or Dauphin, depending on how you pronounce it, who went on to be, she probably still is, deputy head at Hempstead. But she was an extraordinary teacher. And I'd come across her as a probationary teacher and took her on. But no, there was just two of us. And so before it was Bill and myself.
Yep.
And then this is resources in the history department. Yeah, you know, I was talking about resources. this shows also... room 18, there was a history room, so we had a history room, so we had a film projector, and we had a school tape recorder. You remember school video tape recorders?
Mm.
Yeah, I've got a certificate upstairs for the fact I could operate one. There were artifacts and aids, but then games and war games. And then you've got, this is what I was meaning about slides.
I was going to say, did you use a lot of simulations and games?
Not as much as I probably think I should have done. Probably because they took a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, the simulation was usually drama. I did a couple of simulations based around Congress of Vienna, based on things that I've read in teaching history.
Mm.
But the reason there were so many slides was because I inherited the school's the Cambridge History Project, or Cambridge History Latin Project. The Cambridge Latin Project.
Is that an O level or an A level?
I can't remember what it was, but Latin, like many subjects, died at Archbishop Tennyson's, and all its resources were nicked by the history department. So I used to have masses of slides on
ancient history.
Yeah. Cassettes, history not so long ago, life in a monastery.
Ah, the history not so long ago, that's accompanying the TV programmes, isn't it? BBC ones.
Film strips.
Mm-hmm.
You're not short of resources in here. Videos. Spool. Mill Children. Was very powerful. It was BBC, British Social History.
Did you use the How We Used to Live? Or was that more for primary?
I think, I can't remember using How We Used to Live much. So it goes on.
Yeah.
I didn't realise I kept this. But.
I'd like to... photograph it, if that's all right.
Yeah.
Would that be okay? Because it would give me a really good idea of the history department in the mid 80s. Yeah.
Want to photograph all of it?
Yeah, I've got a digital camera.
The easiest thing would be to take it and then send it back to me when you finish with it.
Yeah, if you're happy for me to do
I'm
that.
I'm quite happy for you to do that. I think that would make more sense. I mean, it's. That looks.
This is like a snapshot of what the history department would have looked like at that time. Yeah.
That was.
Over 30 years. Well, see, you did do some 17th century stuff, didn't
you? A level.
Oh, I see.
I used to do 17th century Europe, and Bill used to do 17th century Britain. So. That was an attempt, really, to provide a way into the 30 Years' War, which was accessible, and then we used to use quite a number of books.
You know, in all my learning of history, I did it for A-level as well, and that had more impact on me than almost anything else, the effect that it had on people's lives.
Yeah. Well, it's very difficult to go around Europe without being constantly reminded of the 30 Years' War one way or another.
So you were using sources at A-level, even though obviously you're working with a very conventional syllabus with just essays, or were there source papers at A-level?
No, it was just essays in those days, definitely. I'll leave that there.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Can you remember how you were teaching A level? That was in the comprehensive school as well.
Yeah. Both in the grammar and the comprehensive. There was this church schools consortium, which meant that Archbishop Tennyson's was a boys' school, but because of the church schools consortium, we had girls from Charles Edward Brooks School and Archbishop Michael Ramsay School, and Sacred Heart down. These were all based down the road that runs between Camberwell Green and the Oval. Whose name I've forgotten, but so we had mixed sets at A level, or mixed sex sets, and they were largely done in a seminar format. And because of the consortium, we had blocks of time, so we'd have the whole afternoon or half a morning or the second half of a morning, so they were quite long sessions, and you used to need to break them up. You couldn't just do it in seminar format, so you'd do a bit of time of seminar, you do possibly a bit of input, and that's a fair bit of time going through essays, talking through essays, kind of tutorial work. And you could do, again, if you had the long time, you could do some seminar work and then you could do some individual tutorial work while they were doing some research. But I never managed to get round to doing things like AEB 673, which Kate was involved in, so she'll tell you a lot more about it. So mine were always the very traditional. There were source papers. I think the first question was what was called a gobbet question. And then you had three essays or something. And they were London Board.
So you did London Board, 17th century, both British and European.
Yeah. And when we went into the consortium, I think they used to do the European with me. They did the British Archbishop Michael Ramsay, and they switched from the English Civil War, which Bill had done, to the Elizabethan England culture one, which few schools did, but we tended to do very well on, I think.
That's lovely. So then, moving on, you moved to be an advisor at this sort of critical point.
Largely about GCSE, critical point. And then Paul Armitage, who was at SEC, became an HMI, and there was a vacancy. And I mean, you know what teaching's like as a kind of pyramid. You kind of go from being an assistant teacher to being a head department, and then you look for deputy head jobs or head jobs, and they're few and far between, and you don't really know that you want to do them because you know you won't be doing your subject. And so becoming an advisory teacher on a 2-year secondment in ILIA seemed like a good way of sticking with the subject. It gave me a massive breadth of experience that I hadn't had, because I'd been in this school for the whole of my teaching career, effectively. I had the whole of London. And then I was also doing the examining. So when the SEC job came up, it seemed to be a way of, you know, pursuing the examining and staying with the subject.
So I
stepped into Quango land quite
quite
largely to stay with the subject, I suppose.
Just want to stick with the advisory role at the moment. You said to me that you were just spending quite a lot of time setting up training materials and training teachers. For a lot of teachers, it must have been a big switch if they hadn't done the SHP before then. So what sort of attitudes did you encounter when you were doing training with teachers?
Not particularly hostile ones. There was often, a lot of the time, you'd just be getting across the basics of what change was happening. One of the things that I think I've come to concentrate a lot on in the work that I do internationally now as a consultant is about how you implement change, and how, you know, it's one thing to say it will happen, it's quite another to make it change, isn't it? If you actually look at history teaching, I don't think the national curriculum changed it much at all. It may have changed what the content, but probably not how people taught it. So a lot of it was about, you know, exactly what does this mean? The kind of materials we were producing.
Okay.
things like this.
So this was called Phase 2 training because it was Phase 1 had been SEC trained the exam boards, and then the exam boards trained the local authorities. So Phase 2 was when the local authorities trained the school. So this was very much putting materials together which you would use as the basis of your training. So this is the kind of training booklet we've produced in ILEA for training people about GCSE history. And of course, they could be doing not only the full LEAG ones, they could be doing the ones that were being produced by whatever the boards were called in the Midlands Board or the Northern Board.
Northern Board, NEAB was Northern one,
And and there were still people saying, this is all very well interesting, you know, Mr. Cole, Dr. Cole, but I think I'll stick with what I've got. And you were saying, well, actually, no, you can't.
because
this is going to you know, your O level is not going to go on.
Really?
And that's probably why I'd argue that the switch to GCSE, because it was about assessment and you had no choice in the end, was so much more powerful than, say, the introduction of national curriculum, which for many people reinforced what they were doing anyway, and they continued teaching as they always. And resisting efforts, often efforts from outside by people who wanted to make changes to suit their predilections rather than things that were required. I mean, that was Skidelsky's big complaint about history when we get onto national curriculum. But I mean, these were trying to use materials that have been in the in papers, and the kind of question we're trying to look at. So what does this mean in the classroom? There was stuff in here about schemes of work as well. At least we used to do. I remember Maureen developed a thing on I'll show you it, on planning schemes of work, which was, again, you were saying schemes of work,
well, ones that really made any difference. Because my impression was at first people used to write out a grid and they just put what they were teaching. And they didn't get the fact that they had to put down how the students were going to learn or what they would actually even be doing in the classroom. Then you get ones that had what they were delivering in terms of content plus what equipment they were using and the materials they might be using. And then you finally move on to ones that might have outcomes in them in terms of learning. But,
there we are. This is Colwell and Burns, History Planning and Assessment. And this was the kind of scheme of work that we developed doing this training. So there was a study in depth Germany. And that was an assignment sheet.
Did you actually visit schools and see teachers in their own environment and support them there?
Yeah, the role of an advisory teacher as opposed to an advisor was that you were a non-judgmental support. So we would often be sent to schools at either the request of the school or at the request of the inspector to support a department, but we went in with no kind of inspectorial role. Our role was simply to go in and, if you like, work as a mentor, work with the head of department, look at their syllabus, look at some lessons, talk to them about what they were doing, and just provide another set of eyes, really.
And that was focused on the GCSE implementation?
No, it was
broader than that.
We worked right across. I can't remember going into many primary schools, I have to say, when I was an advisory teacher. I think largely because of GCSE, I probably went into more secondary schools. But I did go into first, second and third year as they were then, as well as fourth, and saw some horrors. I mean, the classic frightener, and which justified the national curriculum ones. I went to one school, some whole summer term they did the assassination of President Kennedy. They had watched the film, they had seen every item of newsreel footage, they got all these resources, they were doing all this lot. And they'd done this for the whole summer term. And I said to these kids, well, you know, but who was Kennedy? Oh, I don't know. And they had no context in which this was pure skills-based history. It might as well have been Sherlock Holmes. Mm. And that was, for me, that was the kind of second generation, you know, kind of take one thing and lose the rest. You know, the bathwater is gone.
Mm.
And I think that's the kind of thing that worried me about those who had taken the skills-based approach and lost the idea that it was actually about teaching history. Mm. But that was an exception, but it sticks in the mind. You know, you just sit there and say,
yeah.
You know, and so you've done Kennedy's assassination. You know?
So what? I wanted to ask you, actually, there seemed to me quite a divide between people who are, well, wanting children to learn quite a bit of history. They're really concerned about children's thinking, like Peter Lee, and some sort of progression in children's thinking, although he would say there's no fixed progression. But and people who see source-based work as a way to enliven children's interest in history. So where would you place yourself?
I think I'd probably be in both camps. I mean, I do think it's very important to get, as I say, this kind of framework, you know, the kind of chronological framework, to develop the kind of conceptual framework, the thinking framework. But within that, sources, and using it broader, you know, taking people out and looking at history and realising that it isn't just about textbooks. I suppose if we go back to one of the most crucial things that I can ever remember reading, it was History Betrayed by Martin Booth.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that was about how a subject which was all about people and it was about the world that they created, etc., had become reduced to reading words on pages in classroom. And so, you know, in that sense, I'd be very much in favour of sources as a way of enlivening, but not, you know, kind of three or four lines. We'll look at it in textbook. You know, these kind of source a sentence.
Yes.
And so it's a question of recognising that those sources are there to help you understand and draw a picture of the past. I think where I draw the line is this view that children could find out about the past themselves from sources. This is almost the kind of assassination of President Kennedy. You know, here's the sources, you work out who killed him. And that suggests that the role of the teacher is simply to stand there and say, well, these are the sources, make your decision. Mm-hmm. You know, I think ultimately the sources might give you an interpretation, but somebody's got to say, well, that's only an interpretation, what about this interpretation? And other things tell us that this happened. Yeah, or that this is probably the way it was going on.
Yes,
yeah. You can't let people go away thinking the English Civil War simply started because Charles I had a beard. Yeah, not that they would, but I take that as a kind of ad absurdium, you know. And sometimes you can see an exercise and look at this portrait of Charles I, why did the Civil War come about?
Oh dear. Yes, this is the problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
In a sense, people not fully understanding how this method works. And what it can be used for.
You see, that's quite an interesting one.
I mean,
you remember that became quite an issue.
The assessment of empathy. Yeah.
Again, something, dear Chris McGovern, his name is carved in my heart. but, you know, empathy, understanding people in the past, is fine. And, you know, the absurd empathy, imagine you are a Viking, is probably something that almost every teacher at some point has done with children somewhere along the line, you know. Well, what would you do if you'd been such and such? And if you look at the really clever empathy episode. And it is interesting that empathy was there as one of the GCSE objectives. In subsequent versions of the criteria, we called it anything but empathy.
Just wanted to pick you up on the empathy issue because it had been there in SHP, but I wonder whether it had been explicitly assessed in the same way as it was in the early GCSEs. Because you assessed SHP as an O-level CSE. But was empathy explicitly assessed?
Not to the same extent.
That was my impression. It became more formalised in the GCSE, and that was its problem.
Well, I think two things happened. One, it became more formalised as a specific objectives, and there was this whole thing about assessing single objectives, single objective assignments, I remember, as a term that was used. So you'd do an empathy exercise, and you'd do a source exercise, and you'd do a cause exercise. And that's because you could only really assess one thing, at least you thought you could. I think that's one thing. I think the other thing was you got a number of examiners suddenly finding that they had to assess empathy. In fact, a number of examiners who, for the first time, were having to write examinations against objectives. And I think there was an element of examiners not fully understanding what it was they were doing as well, which led to the more simplistic kind of questions, really.
So under SHP, empathy had just been part of the mix in terms of the sort of questions asked and the skills assessed. Yeah, that was my impression, actually. Yeah.
This is... I don't know whether you've seen this one. You probably have. That was a kind of answer to the empathy debate.
Oh, yeah, I have, yeah. I think a photocopy of the whole of that.
Chris Portal. And the, I mean, if you look at the individuals involved, Martin Booth, Chris Culpin, Rachel Hamer, John Hamer's wife, Henry McIntosh, Rosemary Reese, Joe Scott, Paul Shooter, Sue Stiles. I mean, there's the same names keep coming up. We'll see it in the textbook too. Henry McIntosh was the editor for that series.
Oh, right.
So, and that's why. And Henry McIntosh was a great mate of John Hamer's. So, individuals in history.
Yes, there is this, you know, well, you call it not quite a cabal, but a sort of group of dominant individuals who are driving the change. And they are greatly influenced by SHP. Yeah. So from that aspect, you can say that SHP, although it wasn't taken up by a majority of schools, it permeated, if you like, the defining opinion.
I seem to remember that at its height, probably it was a third of the GCSEs.
Yeah.
And modern world history was always the most popular. And social and economic declined over the years, and British and European was always no more than 10%.
But you can see how, in a sense, all your dynamic individuals that are involved in curriculum change have come from the SHP stream as opposed to another stream, and therefore the ideas that they carry with them about what makes good history teaching actually get into all the literature and then get into GCSE.
Yeah.
And although it's sort of...
But what, you know, they are very much first generation of SHP, in the sense that they were about a course that was about establishing a chronological framework through the study over time, looking at a period in depth, looking at how history shapes the modern world. I mean, the modern world study was the hardest thing to teach because the textbook was no good. In the sense that... you had a textbook, I used to do Modern China. You had a textbook which was published in 1975, or thereabouts, whenever the SHP textbooks were published. But you were doing this in 1983.
Oh, and of course you've got the Cultural Revolution and all that sort of
thing. Yeah, China had changed a bit.
Yes.
So you had to do quite a lot of work yourself, and you had to become much more aware of... what was going on in the media about China, and you had to pick up on things. So you're actually trying to bridge that gap. So you do a lot of things with them on things like the Long March and Kuomintang and so on, which was kind of the history of China. But then your coursework was trying to get them to use that knowledge to understand something that wasn't in the textbook, something that had happened recently, so whether it was the Cultural Revolution or the Gang of Four purge or whatever. And that's what made it really hard. And I guess, you know, in Northern Ireland, there was one, yes, there was one on Northern Ireland. I guess that was to a certain extent easier because there were sources, it was more often in the press than China.
Yeah.
But I think the European Union one was the Monroe study that nobody ever did. Ian Dawson could tell you which ones they didn't do.
Just not as exciting.
No. it had ceased to be a kind of major issue. Again, that's one of the problems about a modern world study, isn't it? By definition, if it was very exciting in 1975, it might not be in 1983 or whatever.
That's great. That's lovely.
I mean, it is interesting. The empathy debate lost its sting because we stopped using the word empathy.
You were just picking you up on the first generation, second generation idea. Your first generation has seen SHP as a holistic thing. You've got to have all the elements in for it to form a proper coherent course. And what's the second generation?
The second generation are people, I use this kind of loosely, but people who seem to see SHP simply as skills-based history. Mm-hmm. And who lost sight of the importance of the choice of content.
Yeah. And how do you think that's been reflected?
I think it's been reflected in some departments, such as the one I was talking about, where there was that.
But I
think that would be at its extreme. I don't think many people ever threw out the content or the knowledge. And certainly, despite all the kind of press, there was never any suggestion that a national curriculum would ever abandon it, a very deep-rooted understanding of knowledge and understanding. And the fact that it's expressed in content terms, still, largely. But it's understanding that matrix. I revisited a lot of the Stuart Duker pamphlets, which you'd have seen, which were very much kind of attacking what was almost a press creation. But I mean, even people like Sean Lang, the Sacred Cow History Project, was the first time I ever became aware of Sean Lang. He wrote an article in the Times Ed called SCHP, the Sacred Cow History Project, where he was kind of reacting to it as somebody who was not involved in it, and he was criticising it by picking up on the kind of skills-based element. So this is the thing we did, and this, for example, was just a summary of coursework. I'm preparing and producing assignment when coursework was quite new to a lot of history teachers. So that was the kind of thing we did a lot of as advisory teachers. But then Kate was warden of the centre. Kate took maternity leave with her daughter Ellen. It was her first child. And Maureen, who was the other advisory teacher, became acting warden. So for a year, I was the advisory teacher trotting around Ilya on me Todd.
So 1986
to 1998. I started at SEC in April 1988, I think.
So during those 2 years, that sort of critical time, did you get teachers ringing you up and saying, panic, I think I've got the coursework all wrong, or, you know, or I've just had disastrous results? And
No,
the first results wouldn't have come out.
Because the first exam was in summer of 1988,
so it was the run-up.
So it was much more about preparing people. So people in this period were still, they'd either doing the joint O-level CSEs, in which case they were into doing things they wanted to do, or they were still sticking with their O-level or the CSE and not too worried about where it was going.
Right.
And they were the ones who were still saying, well, it'll be all right, we'll stick with our O-level, thank you very much.
That was your main worry, that they were going to head for disaster.
I can remember doing some inset in Lisbon. This was for London East Anglian Group. I got this phone call to go and do some inset in Lisbon in what must have been January of 1988. And when you did inset for LEAG, you had to do it on all four syllabuses. So you had to go. And these were teachers in Northern Ireland who were choosing to do London exam board syllabuses as opposed to the Northern Ireland one. But the level of ignorance effectively what we're talking about, by 1980, summer 88 was the first exam, so right, 87 they were implementing, was kind of quite worrying, given that these kids were going to do their exam in the summer. And there were problems in that first year about people who'd done coursework, which didn't have any relation to the objectives it was supposed to be assessing. And this. But I think, you know, those were expected teething difficulties you get with any new exam. And but, you know, there were also people who, for one reason or another, had not attended any of the INSET.
And you were still involved as an examiner for GCSE, were you? Did you go on to GCSE examining from the joint
I wrote the first GCSE Schools History Project exam, but because I'd joined SEC, I wasn't able to examine it.
Ah, right.
So you'll have come across Angela Leonard as well,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
Well, Angela Leonard was my number two. And so she took over. This is 1988, first GCSE was about Boudicca. So you have a source booklet which is very much about Boudicca.
So this was continued from SCHP, you had a this unseen paper as part of GCSE.
This was the first GCSE, yeah.
How long did the unseen paper continue for then?
Oh, you'd have to check with somebody like Chris Culpin, but yeah. Certainly well into the 90s.
Right.
I think actually I may well have even got into the 21st century, I'm not sure. it went for quite a while. I know that I'd stopped having anything to do with history when it went, because I suspect if I'd had something to do with history I'd have argued for it. But it was quite interesting because it was an investigation and it was unlike anything else that you did in history. And this was quite a nice one, which had a very difficult question at the end about Victorian views on Boadicea.
Did you find you could differentiate that with the lower ability?
I think what's really fascinating is I haven't kept the mark schemes. But look, I mean, this is what the 6 marks there. Well, we would have marked this out of 12. We doubled the marks up. That's right. We doubled the marks up. So we'd have marked it out of 12.
This one's about 19th century here.
The interesting thing about 19th century is you could assume that they had some understanding of the 19th century because you knew they'd done medicine.
Oh, right.
That was the problem of finding a topic that yeah. they hadn't studied. But you see, that's a, going back to what we were saying earlier, that's a classic starter for
yeah.
10 question, yeah. Similarities, dissimilarities, and then explain. So you build up, yeah. You give them the piece of the jigsaw puzzle, then you ask them the hard question, and you can see that, and it's reflecting the marks throughout. So.
That's excellent, thank you. And then you put here, I joined SEAC, not SCC. Was it still SCC when you joined it?
It was still SEC in April 1988. It became SEAC when the Education Reform Act was passed.
Right, so that year.
And at that point they created two bodies. One was the National Curriculum Council, which was based in New York, and the other was SEAC, which effectively was SEC with an A in it.
Yeah, for assessment.
And that was to reflect the fact that it now had responsibility for National Curriculum Assessment as well as examination. So that was the reason for the A. Yeah. And yes, that was the point when I moved into Krangoland. And I mean, the early days of that were all about approving GCSE syllabuses, because every GCSE syllabus had to be approved by the History Committee. Technically, the subject officer, I was subject officer for History, Social Sciences, Government and Politics, O-level and A-level, or GCSE and A-level. And our role was to service the committees. Philip Holles's view, he was the chief executive, was that we didn't need to have any subject knowledge. The subject knowledge was supposed to be in the subject committees. And so you had somebody like John Westaway, who you probably won't have heard of, But John Westaway had been the warden of the Geography Teachers' Centre in Ilia. And when Ilia closed, he joined SEAC. He was made the chemistry officer in SEAC. He later went on to become the geography officer in SCAR. But for his, you know, Philip Halsey's view was that the subject expertise was in the committee. So you had a committee which was made up of representatives from each of the examining boards, the main examining, or the GCSE examining boards. There were six in those days. And then a few others. So you had people like Eric Evans on that committee, for example, representing London East Anglian Group. HMI were represented. John Hamer, Roger Hennessy. NCC were represented, so Nick Tate was on that group. And you had a few people who were there because they had recognised status. And I can't now remember the kind of people who might have been there. But Chris Culpin was on the group, but nominated by one of the examining boards. And so it was the GCSE committee was a group of peers who each had to submit a syllabus to that group for scrutiny by that group. And in fact, the process was that I would analyse the syllabus. I would do an analysis. I would present it to the committee. The committee would then discuss that analysis, and then they'd usually identify things that they wanted to see improved in that syllabus, and then I would go away and I would write a letter to the board saying, thank you very much, the history committee has considered this syllabus, we'd like you to consider the following points and come back to us.
Have you got a copy of it, the syllabus? What was in it? I mean, what level of detail beyond the content? Because the objectives were the same across all GCSEs.
I don't have any copies of syllabuses. I'm sure that somebody like Angela Leonard would have access to them.
Yeah.
I mean, London East Anglian Group.
Well, I found it very difficult with London Board. Well, now I had Excel. They just, what it came down to was that all their stuff's in boxes that have not been sorted in various warehouses and they're just not accessible. I'm intending to go to Cambridge, see if I can get a better response there.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was really pathetic. The response from them. And that was finally after really working very hard to find anyone who would admit they got any past stuff at all.
That's strange.
I know, but it's to do with all these different mergers that they've had into different organisations.
That's why something like AQA might be better.
Up in Manchester,
I'm trying to remember.
Well, I think the Cambridge one might, because they're more stable as well.
Yeah.
But I was very disappointed, so I haven't been able to get hold of anything like that. And it would be interesting to see what you were judging these syllabuses on, beyond the content. You know, you've got a certain range of content.
We had we had the criteria, but we also had what was called an instrument. There were two sets of criteria for GCSE. There was the subject criteria and there were general criteria.
Yeah.
The general criteria, I can only... Can you pause that a minute? I'll go and see if I can find them.